Think about the last time you made a really solid, rock solid promise to yourself that you just weren't going to overreact.
Oh, yeah, we have all been there.
Right. Like you visualize the whole scenario. You tell yourself, okay, when I walk into this meeting or when I get home to my completely chaotic house, I am going to be this absolute sea of calm.
You have a flawless plan.
Exactly. A flawless plan. And then the very second you feel misunderstood or, insulted, that plan just vanishes like smoke.
Poof, gone.
Yeah, you get completely, hopelessly swept away by this habitual current. And it's only much, much later, after the dust finally settles, that you look around and realize you drifted miles off course.
It is such an incredibly humbling and, well, universally human experience. You sort of wake up from that autopilot mode, survey the wreckage, and just ask yourself, how on earth did I end up here again?
That exact disconnect, that gap between our best intentions and our actual messy behavior in the heat of the moment, that is exactly what we are unpacking today.
It's a really big topic.
It really is. We are doing a deep dive into the RAFT program today. Specifically, we are zeroing in on chapter 53, which explores this concept known as the fourth anchor of mindfulness.
Which is, frankly, a major pivot point in this material.
Yeah.
Up until this point in the journey, you might just be like bailing water out of a sinking boat.
Right, just trying to survive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But this chapter asks you to actually start steering the boat.
And to give you, the listener, a quick lay of the land here, the overarching framework of the program is an acronym. It's RAFT, which stands for Recognize, Abandon, Freedom, and Train.
And today's material from Chapter 53 fits squarely into that final stage, the train stage.
Which makes sense, right? Because by the time you reach the training stage, you are no longer just reacting to a four-alarm fire.
Yeah, you've managed to create a little bit of breathing room for yourself.
So now you are actively trying to build sustainable, lifelong skills so those fires just, well, don't start in the first place.
Precisely. You're building the infrastructure.
The analogy that kept jumping out at me while I was reading this was having a navigation app on your phone.
Oh, that's a really good one.
Like, you can have the most sophisticated, constantly updated map in the world just sitting right there in your pocket.
But if you never actually look at it, it doesn't matter.
Right. If you don't actually pull it out and consult it until you've already driven your car straight into a ditch, the map is completely useless.
That really gets to the absolute core of this chapter's mission. It introduces this vital but slightly paradoxical skill, which is learning to remember to remember.
Remember to remember. I love that phrasing.
It sounds so simple, right? But training the mind to actually consult the map in real time, especially under pressure, that is how we stop drifting on autopilot and ending up on the rocks.
So let's walk into the map room then, because to train the mind, you first need to actually know where you are.
Yeah, the text describes this fourth anchor of mindfulness as essentially stepping into the map room of your raft.
And in traditional teachings, this map room is referred to as mindfulness of the dharmas.
Right, and that word dharmas, it often trips people up.
Oh, totally. It sounds very abstract or, kind of mystical.
It really does. But the RAFT program cuts through that beautifully. It translates dharmas simply as repeatable patterns and principles.
I found that translation so incredibly relieving.
Also.
Well, it takes all the mystery completely out of it. It tells you, hey, this overwhelming surge of frustration you are feeling right now, it isn't some brand new, unique catastrophe that the universe invented just to punish you.
Yeah, it's just a pattern.
Exactly. It's just a pattern. And because it's a pattern, it can be mapped.
That is the real power of it. And the map we consult in this training stage, well, it has five key sections.
Okay, walk us through them.
First up, you have the hazards. These are essentially the five hindrances.
And those are sensual desire, ill will, tuning out, anxiety and agitation, and immobilizing doubt, right?
We got it. Those are the rocks in the whirlpools.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't spot them early, they will absolutely sink you.
But you don't just stop at mapping the hazards, do you?
No, not at all. The second section is the five components of body-mind.
Now, can you walk us through the actual mechanics of this? Because reading the list, it can feel a bit philosophical. How does understanding these components practically help someone navigate?
Well, think of the five components as the moving parts of your lived experience.
Okay.
When you get swept away by a compulsion, it usually feels like this one giant heavy monolith of just me and my massive problem.
Oh, absolutely. It feels totally all-consuming.
Right. But if you actually consult the map, you realize that Monolith is really made up of smaller, distinct parts.
Like physical form, basic feelings of pleasant or unpleasant perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness itself.
Exactly. So instead of being crushed by this overwhelming monolithic feeling of, say, I am furious, you can start to dismantle it.
You start noticing the pieces. Like, oh, my jaw is incredibly tight, so that is form.
Yes, and then you might notice you feel a generally unpleasant sensation in your chest, which is feeling.
And then you realize you are playing this whole story on loop in your head about how everyone always disrespects you.
Which would be a mental formation.
Yeah.
Breaking it down like that, it takes away its immense power.
Because you aren't fighting a monster anymore, you're just observing the gears turning.
That is a great way to put it. And that naturally leads right into the third section of the map, which is the sixth sense doors.
Now, we all know the classic five, right? What we see, hear, smell, taste, and touch.
Right. But the really profound shift here is that the program treats thinking as the sixth sense door.
See, that just blew my mind. Treating thoughts as just another sensory input, basically no different than hearing a dog bark outside.
It is huge.
Yeah.
Because we tend to really believe that just because a thought happens inside our own head, it must represent absolute truth.
Or that we intentionally authored it, right? Like, I thought this, therefore it's me.
Exactly. Treating thinking as a sense door completely flips that dynamic. It posits that thoughts are just things happening to you.
They are just ports of entry for reactivity.
Exactly. I mean, you can hear a loud noise outside and choose not to panic.
Yes.
Usually.
Well, similarly, you can observe a harsh thought pop up and just choose not to believe it.
Which is so empowering. And that brings us to the fourth section, the seven supports.
Yes. If the hazards are the storms, the supports are basically the bright, steady inner weather we deliberately cultivate to make the crossing possible.
But these aren't just fluffy self-help ideas like, you know, just think positive thoughts, are they?
Oh, not at all. They are very active countermeasures.
So if you are facing the hazard of tuning out, you know, that heavy lethargic fog where you just want to scroll endlessly on your phone.
We've all been there. In that moment, you would deliberately deploy the support of investigation or energy. It is a highly applied tool.
And finally, we have the fifth section of the map, which is Gautama the Buddha's four realizations.
Yes, keeping true north in view.
And just a quick note for you listening, on subsequent mentions today, we will just refer to him as Gautama.
Sounds good. So his four realizations really act as the ultimate compass here.
They remind us that the goal isn't just winning at life or accumulating wealth or defeating our enemies.
Right. The compass points specifically toward understanding the reality of suffering, abandoning the reactivity that causes it, and moving steadily toward actual freedom.
Okay, so I am tracking with all of this in theory. The map is incredibly detailed.
But I feel a but coming.
I do want to throw a bit of a wrench in the gears here because honestly, applying this feels a little overwhelming.
That is a very fair reaction.
Can you lay out all these hazards, the components, the sense doors, the supports? It sounds exhausting. Like, does this program expect us to achieve some kind of state of moral perfection?
I'm really glad you asked that.
Because are we just trying to be an absolute saint every single waking second of the day?
I hear that concern a lot, actually. And it is so crucial to clarify the intent here. This framework is absolutely not about moral perfection.
Okay, then what is it about?
It is entirely about utility and safety. It is about seeing the consequences of your actions early enough so you just don't crash the raft.
So it's much more pragmatic than pious.
Deeply pragmatic. The raft program acknowledges a very, very uncomfortable truth.
Which is?
That early on in this process, your mindfulness is incredibly fragile.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like, on a quiet Sunday morning when you are well-rested, sure, you can map your sense doors perfectly.
Exactly. But what happens when you are totally exhausted or your blood sugar drops or some deeply ingrained trigger just hits you out of nowhere?
Oh, mindfulness slips away in a fraction of a second.
It really does. You lose the map entirely.
And then you're just navigating by guesswork or by whatever foul mood happens to be blowing through the cabin that day.
And you revert straight back to the autopilot.
Right.
So the fourth anchor is really about building a structural steadiness, one that holds up even when the internal weather gets incredibly violent. It is not about being perfect. It's just about not flying blind.
Okay, I buy the utility of the map, but here is where we hit the real roadblock for me.
Let's hear it.
It is one thing to own a map. It is an entirely different biological challenge to actually remember to use it when the storm hits.
Oh, 100%.
I will give you a real-world example from my own life. Just yesterday, I had my mental map totally prepared for the morning rush hour.
A dangerous place to test it.
Very. I knew traffic would be bad. I promised myself I absolutely wouldn't get agitated.
And how did that actually go?
Well, 10 minutes into the drive, someone completely cuts me off, nearly takes off my bumper, and my brain just flooded with anger.
Naturally.
The plan didn't even exist in my head until 20 minutes later. So how does the brain actually pull off this trick of remembering to remember under actual pressure?
It's fascinating because psychology actually has a specific term for that exact failure you experienced.
Really? What is it?
It is called prospective memory. Prospective memory is basically our ability to remember to carry out an intention in the future.
Oh, like remembering to take the trash out on Thursday morning?
In a mundane sense, yeah. But here, the intention isn't taking out the trash. It's remembering to pause and take a deep breath instead of screaming when you're terrified in traffic.
Which is a lot harder than taking out the trash.
Exactly. And the research paints a very clear, if slightly grim, picture here.
Lay it on me.
Prospective memory is essentially the very first cognitive function to fail when our stress levels spike or when our mental bandwidth is just stretched too thin.
Wow. So in that heated moment on the highway, I still technically knew the map in theory, but I completely failed to retrieve the file, so to speak.
Right. Your brain just couldn't access it through the massive flood of stress hormones.
That makes so much sense.
And neuroscience adds another really interesting layer to this puzzle by distinguishing between proactive control and reactive control.
Okay, break those down for me.
Proactive control is keeping a wise intention actively loaded in your working memory in advance.
Like what?
Think of it as walking outside with your umbrella already open because you can visibly see dark clouds.
Okay, I like that. And reactive control.
Reactive control is trying to scramble and retrieve that intention only after the cue actually appears.
So scrambling for the umbrella when you are already getting absolutely soaked.
Exactly. And usually the umbrella gets stuck in your bag.
Always.
So the RAF program utilizes a proven psychological tool to actively strengthen proactive control. It's called implementation intentions.
I really love how the text frames this concept. It sounds remarkably like we are writing computer code for our own biology.
It is very similar.
We are essentially attempting to override the autopilot system with a strict if-then statement. Like, if a craving rises, then I pause. If anger surges, then I step out of the room.
Exactly. You're not relying on sheer white-knuckle willpower in the moment of chaos.
Yeah.
Because willpower is notoriously unreliable.
You are relying on a pre-written script.
Yes. And that if-then architecture really bridges the gap between knowing what you should do and actually doing it. You decide well in advance exactly how you will behave when specific internal weather appears.
But I have to push back just a little bit again.
Go for it.
Let's say it is 4:59 p.m. on a Friday. And my boss sends a highly critical, really passive-aggressive email.
Ouch.
Right. My prefrontal cortex, the logical coding part of my brain, it isn't just offline in that moment. It is actively on fire with defensive adrenaline.
Very true.
So how does a neat little pre-written if-then script actually survive a real physiological adrenaline dump like that?
That is the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
And the answer is it survives through the actual mechanics of neuroplasticity.
Which requires repetition.
Constant repetition.
Yeah.
Look, the very first time you get that email, the script might fail completely. You might still fire back a defensive reply.
Been there.
But maybe you remember the script 5 minutes later instead of 5 hours later.
That's a small win.
A huge win, actually.
Yeah.
And then the next time, you might remember it while your hands are literally hovering over the keyboard.
Catching it in the act.
Yes. Every single time you successfully interrupt a reactive habit, even slightly, you actually strengthen your brain's capacity to run that code.
You are literally wiring a brand new neural pathway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And over time, this repeated effort fundamentally moves us from a state of fusion to a state of metacognition.
Could you unpack those two terms for us really quick? What does it actually feel like to be in fusion versus metacognition?
Sure. Fusion is essentially complete consumption. You are the defensive anger.
You're completely tangled up in it.
Right. There is absolutely no space between your awareness and the emotion itself. Metacognition, on the other hand, is the ability to step back and just observe the feeling as a passing pattern.
So instead of screaming, I have to send this angry reply right now.
Metacognition allows you to pause and say, ah, I recognize this pattern. This is a massive surge of defensive agitation moving through my body.
It is really the difference between actively drowning in the ocean versus standing safely in the map room of your raft, watching the barometer drop and noting, huh, looks like a storm is blowing in.
Exactly. You still see the storm clearly. You still feel the boat rock under your feet, but you just aren't submerged in the water.
And that psychological distance creates a crucial pause.
Yes. And inside that pause, wiser action actually becomes possible.
Which is incredible. But overriding this autopilot isn't just a neat psychological trick to lower our blood pressure, is it?
No, not at all.
It fundamentally dictates the real-world impact we have on ourselves and, honestly, everyone around us.
Yes, and that brings us to a concept in the chapter that actively challenges how a lot of modern culture treats mindfulness today.
You're talking about ethical mindfulness.
I am, and this distinction really changes everything.
How so?
Well, there is a very popular, highly sanitized version of mindfulness in corporate culture today, right?
Yeah.
It essentially treats the practice as a value-neutral life hack, completely divorced from your actual behavior.
Oh, absolutely. It is the whole idea of, well, I am going to do my 10 minutes of deep breathing so I can be hyper-focused and ruthlessly crush my competition today.
Exactly. It is a completely transactional approach.
Right.
But the RAFT program draws on much deeper philosophical roots, specifically virtue ethics and the concept of phronesis.
Phronesis, which translates roughly to practical wisdom, right?
Yes. Within this framework, mindfulness is inherently ethical. It is never merely just bare attention to what's happening.
True mindfulness is shaped by ethics and directed specifically toward creating less harm, more care, and greater freedom.
Right. The text points to Gotama's advice to his son Rahula, which serves as this brilliant litmus test for this whole idea.
Yeah, he tells him to actively reflect on his actions before he does them, while he is doing them, and after they are done.
Because the metric isn't, did this make me more productive today? The metric is simply, does this lead to affliction?
And if an action leads to harm, whether for yourself or for others, you just don't do it.
Exactly. It forces you to look way beyond your own internal weather. The chapter also references the Sadaka Sutta, which is often called the acrobat.
I love that imagery.
It's beautiful. Uses the imagery of two acrobats balancing together on a bamboo pole. And the core teaching there is that by protecting yourself, meaning maintaining your own steady ethical mindfulness, you automatically protect others.
And conversely, by protecting others through your own patience and harmlessness, you inherently protect yourself.
Yes, the internal and the external are entirely interconnected. You can't separate them.
There is a really powerful quote in the chapter from Sharon Salzberg that brings this right down to ground level for me.
Oh, what's the quote?
She says, "Everyone has the ability to affect the 3 feet around them by behaving more ethically, honestly, and compassionately toward those they meet."
It is so true. Just consider your immediate zone of impact.
Like a literal 3-foot radius.
Right. When you lose your map and let a hazard like ill will completely take over, you don't just suffer internally in a vacuum.
Oh, definitely not. You flood that entire 3-foot radius with toxic energy.
You absolutely do. You snap at the barista, you cut someone off in traffic, you bring all that agitation right home to your family.
So ethical mindfulness really isn't about sitting quietly on the sidelines, blissfully detached, just watching your thoughts pass by like clouds on a summer day.
Yeah. No, you are fully engaged. You are standing in the raft, hands firmly gripping the rudder, actively asking, what is this specific choice going to set in motion right now?
Safe passage requires active steering. You have to recognize what is trying to board your vessel through those sixth sense doors.
And you have to make a concrete ethical decision about what you are actually going to do with it.
And since we are the ones actively steering, we are completely responsible for looking closely at the trail we leave behind in the water.
Which brings up that really profound metaphor from the text, the idea of the wake.
Right. I mean, just like a heavy boat moving quickly through a narrow channel, every single thought we feed, every word we speak, and every action we take leaves a wake behind it.
And a heavy wake violently rocks every other boat in the water.
Huh.
It ripples all through our own nervous systems, and it literally crashes into our relationships.
The RAFT program provides some really intense journaling prompts to help you actually examine this trail, doesn't it?
It does. The prompts essentially ask you to do a forensic analysis of your own behavior.
Which can be tough.
Very tough. They ask you to look closely at a specific moment of forgetting and actively contrast it with a moment of remembering.
Like asking, what specific trigger pulled you away that time? Was it just physical exhaustion? Or was it some deeply held internal story of not being good enough?
Exactly. And on the flip side, you ask, what tiny, almost mechanical actions actually helped you come back to the map.
You know, I actually want to challenge you, the person listening to this right now, to run this diagnostic on yourself today.
It is a great exercise.
Try to visualize a recent time when you completely forgot your training. You got swept up into an old habitual reaction. Maybe it was a spiral of anxiety that kept you up all night, or a really bitter argument where you said some things you seriously regret.
We all have those moments.
We do. Now, take that moment and compare it to a time where you felt the exact same trigger, but you actually did remember to pause.
Look at the wake you left behind in both of those specific scenarios.
Right. How long did it take you to mentally recover from the first one? And how did the people around you react to the second one?
Just sitting with that stark contrast is incredibly sobering. But honestly, that is where the actual learning happens.
And diagnosing the recovery part is just as crucial. Like, what actually helps you find your map again when you are totally lost in the dark?
Is it literally stepping outside for a breath of cold air? Is it writing the feeling down on paper?
Or maybe simply admitting out loud to someone, hey, I am just really overwhelmed right now.
All of those are valid. But as we talk about examining our mistakes in our wake, we really have to underscore a vital point here to guard against self-judgment.
Yes, please.
This entire practice is absolutely not about achieving perfection.
Because we are biological creatures.
Exactly. We will drift. We will absolutely forget our training. We will react poorly. And sometimes we'll only realize after the fact that we have drifted miles off course and caused a massive disruptive wake.
The navigation app was open right there on the passenger seat, and we still drove the car straight into the ditch.
It happens to the most seasoned practitioners in the world. But the RAF program emphasizes a truly beautiful truth here. The failure itself is a core part of the training.
So the goal isn't just building up a flawless streak of never forgetting.
No, the training lives entirely in the returning. It is the actual courageous act of remembering, looking honestly at the wake you cause, repairing whatever harm was done, and then just beginning again.
Every single time you execute that return, your mindfulness becomes a little less fragile.
Yes. You're running the code again. Even after a major bug completely crashes the system, you reboot, you run the script, and that neural pathway gets just a little bit stronger.
You apply and reapply the effort, moment to moment, but always with profound kindness toward yourself.
That kindness is essential.
Well, this has been an incredibly rich exploration of the map room today.
We've covered a lot of ground.
We really have. We've traced the five sections of the map, decoded the neuroscience of perspective memory, and navigated all the real-world responsibilities of this hands-on-the-rudder ethical mindfulness.
And to ensure you, the listener, have access to all the blueprints we discussed today, you need to know where to find them.
Absolutely. The RAFT to Freedom workbook, which contains chapter 53 and literally everything we explored today, is written by Dr. Catherine Jacob and Vince Cullen.
And they're making the entire 66-chapter program freely available online for anyone who needs it, which is amazing.
It really is an incredible gift. You can access the full workbook right now at RAFT2Freedom.org.
It is an unparalleled resource for anyone attempting to map their own internal weather and find safer passage.
I completely agree. As we wrap up this deep dive into the RAFT program, I want to leave you with something actionable to mull over.
Aloha, Mark.
Exactly. It's a self-reflection prompt adapted straight from the text we explored today. What would it look like, in one very concrete area of your life, to remember your map a little sooner and steer a little wiser?
That's a great question. And as you examine that area of your life, keep in mind the words of John Peacock from the close of the chapter. Mindfulness is always ethically imbued. It is never a neutral process.